The following presentation was recorded at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
I ask his name. The colloquy is an Anabaptist view of education. This afternoon, we're looking at applying the philosophy of education, individualized versus traditional classroom. The question is, in what ways do each of these fulfill or violate biblical or Anabaptist views of education and of the church? Jesus said, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, pray for them which persecute you and despitefully use you. Sleitheim Confession, Article 6, says, the sword is an ordering of God outside the perfection of Christ. The secular rulers are established to wield the same. I'm just skipping here. Many who do not understand Christ's will for us will ask whether a Christian may or should use a sword against the wicked for the protection and defense of the good or for the sake of love. The answer is unanimously revealed. Christ teaches and commands us to learn from him. Conrad Grebel wrote, true Christians use neither worldly sword nor engage in war, since among them taking human life has ceased entirely, for we are no longer under the old covenant. The gospel and those who accept it are not to be protected with the sword, neither should they thus protect themselves. Peter Reitemann wrote, Christ, the Prince of Peace, has established his kingdom, that is, his church, and has purchased it by his blood. In this kingdom, all worldly warfare is ended. Therefore, a Christian has no part in war, nor does he wield the sword to execute vengeance. Albert York was born in the Tennessee Mountains in the late 1800s. Those mountain men were men who were expert with the long rifle. He grew up to be one of the best. He did not live a Christian life in his youth, but in his early 20s, he became converted. He joined, I guess you would say, a fundamentalist church. One of their strong tenets was thou shalt not kill, so it wasn't a real good fundamentalist church, I reckon. But he wholeheartedly accepted the doctrines of his church. World War I came along. He was getting close to 30. He was still single, big, raw-boned, 205-pound man. He was drafted. He asked twice for a conscientious objector exemption. He was not granted that. He went to camp. When they drilled him and practiced targets of 200, 300, 500 yards, no problem to him. He didn't mind shooting at the bullseye. When they asked him to shoot at human silhouettes, he told his commander he couldn't do that. His commander disgusted with him, and then he handed him over to a superior commander who was much more knowledgeable in the scriptures. They went back and forth on this thing, and finally this commander, seeing the agony of his soul, sent him home to think about it. For 2 days, he spent in the woods agonizing over this thing with God. And he decided, I'll fight for my country. He was sent to France as the Allies in 1918 were making a major offensive against the Germans. And at one particular assignment, where they were pressing forward, they were pinned down by some German machine gun fire. So he with 17 other men went around the flank to try and take care of this problem. And they surprised some Germans. They surrendered. And then a German machine gun nest caught sight of their activity and turned their guns on them and killed about half of the 17. And York noticed that they were shooting high enough not to kill the prisoners. And so he crawled around on his belly to try and get into a position. The other ones that were still alive were basically guarding the prisoners. He started picking off the Germans just like they had those turkey shoots in the marksman's contest at home whenever the turkey bobbed his head up against a log, he's shot. You've got the head, you got a turkey. He killed 17 Germans with 17 shots. And then the Germans realized he was kind of acting alone. They sent 7 or 8 men towards him. I'm not sure which, the accounts differ. He either was out of ammunition with his rifle, or he dropped one with his rifle and took his pistol. They made a mistake of coming in single file. He shot them just like shooting ducks at home, all 7 of them. A German major was so impressed with his marksmanship, he said, "Don't shoot anymore. I'll tell them to surrender." So he did. And so Sergeant York marched these men back towards camp with the major in front of him, 2 lieutenants on each side of him. Every time they came to a German machine gun nest, the major ordered them to surrender, the German major. He got back into camp with 132 German prisoners. That is not biblical, and it's not Anabaptist. You can take a popular Protestant U.S. history book, and this is what it says. Alvin York, a tall, red-haired mountain boy from Tennessee, was a new Christian when World War I began. He was hesitant to enter the war because of his understanding of the Bible, but when he became convinced that it was his duty to fight, he enlisted in the army, determined to help his country win a victory for freedom. Then it gives a little bit of this account, and he ends up saying, Marshal Foch, who was the Allied commander-in-chief in World War I, described this deed as the greatest thing accomplished by any private soldier of all the armies of Europe. That's the traditional classroom approach. You find that in the traditional classroom approach. That's not biblical. That's not Anabaptist. In the individualized approach, a teacher in a Mennonite individualized school using a patriotic curriculum married a National Guardsman. I'm not sure they stayed in the church or not. Neither is that biblical nor Anabaptist. My point is that the curriculum, whether individualized or classroom, should be in harmony with the Bible. We should always be looking at subject matter from God's perspective. And some people say, well, that's what the teacher's for, to correct these things. Why should the teacher spend his time counteracting the influence of the text? Why should he not spend his time supporting the influence of the text, reinforcing it? So much for that concern. Traditional classroom. Let me say one more thing here, several things here yet in introduction. We have individualized versus traditional classroom. We have biblical Anabaptist views. We have several adjectives here, traditional, biblical, Anabaptist. Just to understand what we're talking about, the traditional classroom approach as we know it is less than 150 years old. In the elementary, in the article in the World Book Encyclopedia under elementary school history, it says in 1847, the Quincy Grammar School in Quincy, Massachusetts became the first public school to have a complete system of separate grades for the children. In 1848, its new building became the first to have a separate room for each grade. Slightly different statistics were given in an article in our local weekly paper. A local teacher was writing about some of his concerns, but he had this statement. And so for the first time in 228 years since the Pilgrims had landed in Plymouth in 1620, a school in America was broken up into something called grades. To St. Louis, he says St. Louis rather than Massachusetts, belongs the dubious honor of being the place where it all started. And each succeeding year, as more and more schools adopted grades, the emphasis continued to slowly shift from schools designed for the benefit of students to schools designed essentially for teachers and administrators. Now, you don't necessarily have to agree with that, but as far as his facts, the advent of classroom schools would be correct. Think back to the pioneer times. And if you've read those stories, what I gather in some of those schools was that you have these little petite girls in the advanced readers, and you have some of these big husky guys that are still in the pre-primer. They're about as old as the teacher. So evidently, the students passed on from one level to the next based on their performance and not on their age. Are we willing to consider the question in modern education, why are children grouped by age? One more thing as far as studying a topic like this, just to illustrate something we need to be cautious about. Here in Martyr's Mirror, page 931, giving an account of an interrogation of an Anabaptist, it says, "The schoolmaster of Newbart, called Master Peter Kloss van der Linden, who had disputed 5 hours with Jan Peters, and was greatly embittered against this people," now notice the schoolmaster is embittered against the Anabaptist, "gives nevertheless this testimony concerning them, that their chief and principal errors are," and he lists those errors, "they didn't baptize infants and didn't believe that Christ's flesh and blood was in the communion," and so on, or some other things. But anyway, "but that with this exception, their life and conversation is better than that of many others, and that they also seek to bring up their children in better discipline and fear of God than many other people, that he also had of their children in his school, who were apter and learned more readily than the others." So from this, I guess you could conclude that the Anabaptists sent their children to public schools, except they weren't public. I guess they would have been Catholic. So is that what we should follow? My point is that you can decide on your view, and then you can find information to back it up, whatever you want to. So we must be careful about that. Okay. The Anabaptist view. I asked several people, you know, what's the Anabaptist view of education? I had a little bit the same problem that Brother John Martin did, is finding, getting a hold of that. One brother had a very good response. I think he summarized it. He said, "Teach them to read." In Minna Simon's little article, "The Nurture of Children," he says, "Keep them away from good-for-nothing children, from whom they hear and learn nothing but lying, cursing, swearing, fighting, and mischief. Direct them to reading and writing. Teach them to spin and other handicrafts suitable, useful, and proper to their years and persons. If you do this, you shall live to see much honor and joy in your children." And that's about the extent of what he had to say. I mean, in other places where he wrote similarly, that's what he wrote. Or you can take the Martyr's Mirror. Maybe I'll read just one account. But it was teach them to read. Teach them the scriptures. One account here in Martyr's Mirror. Let's see. This is on page 565. This father, and you have numerous instances of this in Martyr's Mirror. The father is about to give his life, and he's writing a letter to his son. He says, "If you have time and opportunity, use diligence to learn to read and write, that you may learn and know the better what the Lord requires of you." That was their view of education. We could read some from a book about Christopher Dock. That's not strictly Anabaptist. That's colonial American, although probably Dock was significantly influenced by the Anabaptist view. I mean, you know, there was maybe some tie back to their view. The biblical view of education, I'll just summarize. I would encourage you to read the article on education in the Zondervan Pictorial Bible Encyclopedia, 5 volumes. They have an excellent treatment of Jewish aims and origin. Just very briefly, one thing I thought was good, the way they pointed out, they said in Sparta, the aim of education was the obliteration of the individual for the sake of the state. In Athens, it was the training of the individual in the service of culture. For the Romans, it was the training of the individual in the service of the state. But God's people, the Jews, their aim in education was the training of the individual in the service of God. And that makes all the difference. It talks in there a little bit about the Jewish education. 75 B.C., Simon ben Shetach decreed that children should attend elementary school. That was the house of the book, where they studied the Torah with its explanation. Then they also had something similar maybe to a secondary school called an academy, where the rabbi led discussions about the interpretation of the Torah. Well, in the Bible, you have Ezra teaching the people. Was that a classroom session or a preaching service?
the methods that were used in the Bible, oral, you know, here, remember, there was mnemonic devices. The scriptures include mnemonic devices to remember. There was written instruction. There was catechetical instruction, question and answer, a lot of rote instruction. As far as early Christian times in this book, The History of Christian Education, under early Christian education, talking about the manner in which Jesus taught, says the manner in which Jesus carried on instruction was natural and informal instead of formal. Typically, it was conversational, consisting of question and answer, dialogue and discussion, and storytelling. Little did he try to instruct passive hearers by using a continuous discourse. He knew, as did contemporaneous Jewish educators, that in order for the learner to come to know, he must listen attentively and participate in discussion, asking and answering questions. He made frequent use of the question, especially in beginning instruction, both asking questions and encouraging questions from others. For Jesus, the individual was the primary consideration. And then speaking a little bit more about the early schools, the method of teaching in catechumenal schools was basically catechetical, that is, question and answer. No more than the Jewish rabbis before them did the early Christian teachers try to teach passive hearers by continuous discourse. And their instruction was not mere questioning with response by rote answers. It savored more of the nature of dialogue in that pupils as well as teachers both ask and answer questions. Often it was the pupil who asked the question and it was the teacher who answered it. Each pupil was handled according to his individual needs. The catechist might ascertain these needs by preliminary questioning and thus make the pupil's error or lack the starting point for his special instruction. The individual was to be caused to know for himself the truth, not merely to hear it. In the instruction of catechumens or the pupils, it was the individual pupil who was taught, not an assembly of pupils which was sprayed with content the teacher had learned. Now, I guess you can take from those quotes and see them through whichever glasses you want to wear. Our topic deals with, basically, our topic deals with instructional methods and really biblical or Anabaptist view. Either way, I think it's a little hard to specify the methods. In fact, how important are methods? Methods are important, aren't they? Consider this. Should we look at and analyze the methods, or should we determine what kind of results we want and then look for the methods that will produce these results? One brother I asked about the Anabaptist view of education, he said, you're not going to find an articulated view. He said, look at how they viewed life, what they wanted to accomplish, what life view they wanted the people to have, and then work backwards and decide what's going to get you to that point. Well, that leaves it pretty open-ended. So, given now, we're assuming, accurately, we can assume or summarize the biblical and Anabaptist view of education is training the individual in the service of God, teaching children to read and to lead Christian lives. Life center is moral rather than intellectual, and the development of character is of primary importance. I didn't read all the quotes that included those, but that is a fair summary, I think. Now, let's look a little bit more at this question. In what ways do the traditional classroom or the individualized fulfill or violate biblical or Anabaptist views of education and of the church? I want to speak to some things, the concerns that people have, and my purpose here this afternoon is not to convince anyone of a particular position. You know the saying, a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. And so that's a rather fruitless aim. But my main aim is to help to understand the other person's point of view, whichever the other point is for you. So now considering this, the traditional versus individualized, One of the main concerns that is raised is the place of the teacher. The place of the teacher. In the biblical model, you have Jesus as the biblical model. He taught the disciples. You had the teacher, you had the disciples. Now, just a question for you to think about. What percent of Jesus' ministry, as recorded in the Gospels, involved Jesus in small group or person-to-person interaction? If you don't see the significance of that question, we won't belabor it. But the idea of a teacher as one who knows, dispensing to those who don't know. You know, in the classroom, you have a teacher, it's said, and in individualized, you don't. You have a monitor, a supervisor, or somebody with another title, but you don't have a teacher. I taught 6 years in a classroom setting, and then I taught 1 year in an individualized setting. And in my ignorance, I didn't realize that I wasn't allowed to be a teacher in an individualized setting, and so I went on and taught. I was in charge. Now you say, did I lecture? Did I have class discussion? Not as much, not near as much as in the class setting, but I was just as much the authority. I directed the students what to do. They weren't just doing whatever they felt like doing. Now, this is not to say that the system can't be abused if the authority is taken from the teacher. Another major concern is the place of the group. The biblical and Anabaptist view of the group is a people learning to work together, bearing with each other. The whole New Testament church life revolves around a group setting of closely interrelated people. If I understand it properly, the Anabaptist concept of the brotherhood would be that the individual sacrifices for the benefit of the group. Not only goods, but also ideas. Now, is that right? I say I understand that the Anabaptist concept of brotherhood would be that the individual sacrifices for the benefit of the group, not only his economic possessions, but also his ideas. Romans 15:2. Maybe I'll have to turn to that. Thought I could quote it. Romans 15:2. Let every one of us please his neighbor for his good to edification. Galatians 5:13. Only use not liberty for an occasion to the flesh, but by love serve one another. Yes, we have liberty in Christ Jesus. That the law of ordinances contained in commandments, or to have that backwards, that middle wall of partition between us and God has been broken down, so we do not live by dogma anymore. We have a new life in Christ. What do we do with that freedom? Not an occasion to the flesh, but by love serve one another. We are more accountable yet to serve one another than they were in the Old Testament. We have more ability to do it. Now, one more scripture yet, 1 Peter 4:10. As every man hath received the gift, even so minister the same one to another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. Everything we have, we're to use for the benefit of the other person, not ourselves. Some say that the individualized violates this because it's everybody out for himself. In the traditional classroom, we learn to work together because the more able ones need to wait on the slower ones. They need to bear with them, be patient and long-suffering. Let's consider that not just for 6 to 16-year-olds, but for 6 to 60 years old and beyond. It's certain that we should bear with those whose gift is less, be it in book learning, carpentry skills, or business acumen. Does that mean we limit our work or progress to the other person's ability? How does it work in real life? Consider Brother A, who is he's a dairy farmer. This is just a hypothetical example. But he is a very good dairyman. He is a good manager. He has it all put together. maybe my figures are off, but let's say that his herd average is 22,000 pounds. Now here is Brother B, who is just as hard a worker, and he is just as spiritual, but he just doesn't have it quite, just not quite as gifted, should we say? And his herd average is 18,000. Now should Brother A, instead of trying to improve his herd average anymore, should he maybe take on some other type project like raising steers until Brother B gets his herd average up to 20,000, and then maybe Brother A can start working on getting his up to 24,000. You see, we're each responsible for to use our abilities to the maximum for God's glory. It's not near as easy for him to take minutes at a meeting as it is for Brother B. Each one is to use his ability according to the way God gave it. He's not to limit that ability because somebody else doesn't have quite as much ability as he does. So, you know, which approach is the truest to reality? And my desire here isn't to counter people's concerns, but it's to balance them. Now, if you want an even stranger thought, consider this. Large group, age-graded instruction of the child violates God's design. I'm not saying you have to agree with it. I just said consider it. How does present-day classroom structuring match the way God structured the home? If God wanted one-grade groupings, he would have designed mothers to have litters. The home was designed by God, but schools were designed by men. And people say, but you're mixing apples and oranges. The one is the home, the other is the school. We're looking at what is best for the child. The school is not an entity of its own. It needs to find its authority either under the home or the church. Because as established as an institution, you don't have it in Scripture. You do have the home and the church. Well, I want to consider a little bit more some of these things related to the place of the teacher, the place of the group, their importance. Is it true that everybody should be somebody else's disciple? 2 Timothy 2:2, Paul told Timothy, "The things that thou hast learned of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others." That would, if you want a proof text, that would almost be it, that everybody should be somebody else's disciple. So is the modern traditional classroom approach the only approach that accomplishes this? You know, surely that was happening before 1850, wasn't it, the passing on of the faith. In other words, do you have to lecture to a group to be a teacher, to transmit knowledge, to pass on the faith to the next generation? And I'd like to go a step further. If everybody should be somebody else's disciple, to what extent? God has given gifts to the church, leadership gifts, ability to influence, and this is to be used for God's glory. How much do we follow the leader and how much do we follow the Bible? And we say, well, there's no difference if you have godly leaders. But you know how it works in life. People go to this seminar to hear what this speaker has to say. You know, they come to Faith Builder to see what Brother Melvin has to say about the problems and solutions. Who do we get for revival meetings in our churches? See, we're all in this boat together. You know, the popular speaker. People must go to the book, like the Bereans. Are our people too people dependent? Well, some would say there are not enough people dependent. They're too independent. If I'm not making myself clear, you think I'm using twisted arguments to complicate a simple truth, we'll speak to it in the discussion period. I'm talking about the importance of the teacher. He should be molding and influencing lives, but do we carry that way of thinking too far? Do we become followers of influential persons rather than finding our unity in the person of Jesus Christ and his word? I could go a little bit more there yet, but maybe I'll go on now to the next question. What problems are encountered in each, and what are the possible solutions? Okay, the individualized approach, the problems. And these would not necessarily be the way someone else would list them. And I haven't listed them necessarily in a order of priority, but to me, this is one of the main problems. It's heavily dependent on one learning style or mode, which is the visual mode. The child reads and reads and reads, and if he can't read, I mean, he's just out of it. There are different kinds of learners, you see. Not everybody gets things best by reading. There are tactile learners where they learn by feeling. A lot of hands-on things the way they learn. There are oral learners. They hear more by what somebody else says, whether it's another student or the teacher, than by reading it in the book. And so I see that's a weakness, a problem with the individualized approach. In other words, like one teacher said to me, the student needs to read it, he needs to hear it, and he needs to say it. And there's not as much opportunity for that in the individualized approach. The solutions maybe are only partial solutions. There needs to be a heavy emphasis on reading. In other words, unless you really go individualized and you have a different program for each child, in other words, you have a tactile program for a tactile learner, an oral program for an oral learner, and a visual program for a visual learner, unless you go that route, about the best individualized can do is strengthen the reading skills. And so you have a heavy emphasis on reading. That's why individualized programs often encourage the use of a reading machine. Emphasize reading skills. Emphasize oral reading. Yes, an individualized school can have oral reading. And when a child learns to read orally well, it helps him with his silent reading. So you have to make reading skills a priority. Like I say, a total solution would involve designing a completely different, and so that included listening skills also. In other words, they can learn note-taking and listening other than from the teacher. Demonstrations, essays, really, they can be included without too much trouble in individual. I don't see that's a big problem. But the group give and take, you know, the discussion, the verbal expression, there's not as much of that. So the individualized system needs to put forth special effort to provide group activities, to provide group discussion beyond music and art and recess. In the devotional period, current events, you can have a current event period, group drill, pick a subject and do it as a class. Now our school is, even though we have 6 elementary students in grades 2 through 7 last year it was, so you have 6 students in 6 different grades, we still considered it classroom. But like in the one subject, we had 2 fifth graders and 2 seventh graders, put them in one group and studied Into All the World. It was a new book, they hadn't had it yet, and it's something that they could all manage. And like I say, this wasn't individualized, but you could do that type of thing in an individualized setting to provide for some class atmosphere and skills. In doing that, and adding these group things also helps meet the problem of a lack of variety. A creative teacher can provide variety. You're not in the individualized setting, you're not, or you shouldn't be locked into an ironclad system with absolutely no room to maneuver. I don't believe in that kind of an individualized system. Another problem in individualized approach is that the student needs to take more responsibility for his own learning. You might say, that's not a problem, that's a benefit. Well, I'll tell you, it can be a real problem. If a student doesn't have much motivation and self-discipline, he just doesn't get anywhere. But that's a problem a teacher faces all the time. But what's the solution to that? The teacher has to be a good motivator, has to find something to turn that student on. Maybe your incentive system, work on study skills, would be some partial solutions to that problem. Another problem with the individualized is the repetition of activities and explanations. In other words, you do it to one student here, and 3 days later you do it to another student here. Or maybe 3 weeks later would be more realistic. You can partly remedy that by having students work together in certain ways, like maybe students in 702, one is in 702, another is in 704, another is in 706 science. You can have all 3 of those students do their experiments together. And one already had it, and the one's coming to it, they can all learn from it together. You can pull a few students together in a subject. For instance, you may have 3 students only a few units apart in algebra. So you can say, well, in algebra this year, you students are going to do your work together. And I'll help you each day or a couple times a week. I'll give you a little help in the subject. and don't vary this subject. You vary your other subjects, but we'll do this one together. That way you don't have to this week and then 2 weeks later and then 3 weeks later, you know, explain the same thing to the three different students. Another weakness of the individualized approach is the weak teacher image. They do not serve as a central figure in the classroom. I don't know if that is a real problem or a perceived problem. In some cases, it's a real problem when the system is abused, when the curriculum and the procedures are allowed to be the authority rather than the teacher. You know, the parents like it when their children can get done fast and graduate early and help them at home. The students learn to beat the system. You know, they learn how to go through the book and make the score and go to the next book, but they're not really learning the material. The teacher needs to have the authority to say, wait a minute, we're going to stop, we're going to learn this. And if that authority is taken away from the teacher, then you do have a problem. We need to emphasize to parents as well as students, you know, what is important is how much we learn, not how many units we can get through. So what's the solution to weak teacher image? Reestablish the authority of the teacher. And partly for that to happen, the teacher needs to know what he's doing. A sixth problem with the individualized approach is individualism. At least that's what some people say, and it's probably a valid concern. So I would say, you know, if as much as that's a problem, emphasize school accomplishments rather than individual accomplishments. If the school completes X number of light units by a certain date, we'll have a picnic. Or if the school has a certain average for this quarter, we'll, you know, do some activity together. That way, they're all pulling together. You know, the student who are learning is a greater problem, his average may only be 85 or 86. But then the better student, you know, he should be getting the 95s and 96s. So you make a group effort out of these activities. Another way, I would think, to curb individualism would be to have the more capable students assist, teach them to serve. And this, you should be doing this all the time in any kind of school situation. Maybe they can be giving other students spelling words, grading math drills, helping younger or slower students, helping with bulletin boards, you know, whatever they can do to assist the school and the teacher. Another weakness of the individualized approach is teachers with a lack of training and preparation. Might be training in group management, might be training in academic knowledge. What's the solution for that? Well, faith builders. Brother Tucker is really supposed to speak to that. I think something we should give serious consideration to is apprenticeship teaching with some directed study. Okay, what are some of the problems encountered in the classroom situation and some solutions? One of the problems is, and see what is the problem in one tends to be a strength in the other. A problem with the classroom approach is giving students the personal attention they need. A couple years ago, a brother went along with me to Teachers Institute. He was teaching an individualized setting. And so on the way home, I said, well, what did you think of it? He said, in every talk and in every workshop, one of the complaints was we don't have time to meet the individual needs of the student. He said, I have 5 hours every day. So what's your solution to that in the classroom setting? He said, you simply have to make an effort and perhaps adjust your sight to see your class as 15 or 20 individuals rather than the class. Don't schedule your day so full that you don't have left time for giving individual attention. Don't talk too much. Greet students individually by name. Take an interest in them personally. Learn to know them as a person, what their hobbies are. And I know this is easier said than done. Second problem with the individualized approach is the range of ability in the average classroom. Upper elementary classroom, you probably have a 4-grade range in ability in any given grade. So what the teacher has to do, I've heard, at least in teacher institutes and so on, you aim for slightly less than the middle. For the more individual student, the more able student, you require more thorough work, perhaps extra work in the way of writing assignments, projects, not just dull work or busy work, something interesting and profitable. Also, the more able student can, again, help with classroom duties. Third weakness of the classroom approach can be a weakness is that the student can get by without personal discipline or effort. Failure to assume personal responsibility. He's bright enough that from what the other students say in the class discussion, what the teacher says, he can pick up enough to get by and not really have to put himself into his work. So really that boils down again to the role of the teacher as a motivator. You can't force a child to learn. You have to motivate him. Maybe you need to have a man-to-man talk with that child about personal responsibility and accountability for what God has given. I had a student one time that was pretty bright, and he was coasting along all right in his schoolwork. Some schools, children who are really bright, they really get put up on a pedestal. I told this boy, I said, until you get over your laziness, you're not going to be much good to the Lord. And I don't think he was used to being called lazy because he really wasn't lazy at home. It's just that maybe school was boring to him. I don't know. But he came out all right. Not because of that. I guess he just grew in his Christian experience. But that can happen, that they don't really put forth the effort because they can coast. Another weakness or limitation of the classroom approach is that the student's progress, how far they can advance, is pretty dependent on the teacher. And you say, well, that's good. That's the way it should be. A classroom school is not going to teach Algebra 2 or Chemistry unless they have a teacher that can teach it. And the teacher that is good at teaching long division to the fourth grade child and also the electron configuration of the elements to the senior high student is rather rare. So it's the problem of offering a wide variety of subject matter to a small student population. My experience was I taught, like I say, 6 years classroom setting. I had 7 students in the high school most of those years. The last year I taught the individualized approach, and I had 14 students in a range from about 6th level work to 11th level work. If I'd have been giving them the equivalent of what they were getting in the individualized approach, I'd have had to have about 25 different preparations every day to find time to do it. But with this problem of offering a wide variety of subject matter to a small student population, how do you do it in the classroom? Well, I guess you spread yourself thin. You put a little more responsibility on the student. Maybe you use some materials that are a little more student-friendly, that don't take as much teacher input. The classroom approach works best when there's a fair number of students at about the same ability level. Now, see if you feel like this is a valid concern. How do you get 15 students on the same ability level? Well, you can have a community school where, you know, people from different persuasions come to the school, and I really have some problems with that approach. Or you can have a lot of Mennonites living on a pile, and I'm not sure that's God's will. So, just a concern. Okay, now the last question. Should and can these two types be combined, and if so, how? Well, to me, the obvious answer is yes, they can. They're not mutually exclusive. They can be blended. Now, perhaps I'm assuming some things that others don't. If you think that one approach has a teacher and the other one doesn't, there's not much way you can blend them. But I believe either approach needs the best teacher you can get. There's a great need for trained teachers. A good teacher, a good school is going to use an efficient approach as well as an approach that will prepare the student for further learning in life. In either approach, if you don't have a school board working together and directing the school, or you don't have a supportive patron body, you're headed for lots of problems. Well, how can these two types be combined? In general, each type has its strengths and weaknesses. If you're teaching one type, then you will use the strengths of the other type to minimize the weaknesses. If you're teaching in an individualized setting, you'll put forth special effort in planning to provide for group activities, group learning activities. Even if you only got 2 students on this level, they, you know, they're ready for the third level and they're ready for living together on God's earth. Well, that's the first time they have a textbook light unit combination. It's often kind of hard for them. So you take those 2 students and you conduct a sort of semi-classroom. In a classroom approach, you have to make a special effort to relate to each child as an individual. Find activities to challenge the more able student. Some ways they can be combined, you might have the classroom approach for grades 1 to 8 and individualized for grades 9 to 12, or you could break it 1 to 6, 7 to 10, whatever your situation is. You could do it by subject matter. You could have individualized in four subjects and then have a grouping in one subject, maybe social studies or science. You pick the subject that's going to be the most efficient and feasible for your school. The classroom approach loses some of its benefits when there's just one pupil in the class. So if you do the, you have a small individualized school, and you're going to try and do one in class, you try and pick a subject, like I say, where you can pull people from a variety, like we did the fifth and seventh graders all studying the fourth grade book. You could have, like one classroom teacher I talked to some years ago was teaching grade 7 to 10, and he divided his periods into 15-minute segments. So I guess the other 45 minutes for the rest of the classes was personal responsibility. That was sort of a combination, it seems to me. Well, these ways of combining them is certainly not exhaustive. The teacher needs to be creative and adaptive. You might ask, which camp am I in? I guess it seems like I stick up a little bit for the individualized, partly because I have trouble believing that our modern mass production assembly line methods of education are the epitome of educational pedagogy. Also realizing that the personal classroom approach has considerably more historical precedent than the eighth-grade classroom approach, and also somewhat from my experience. But you see, my experience has been in small schools. But as far as method, I'm more concerned if what we teach is sound biblically, and I'm concerned about defending a specific method. I asked one brother to give me some ideas for this talk, and so he sent me a list. He had 19 disadvantages of the individualized school, 19 disadvantages of the classroom school, I think 13 advantages of the classroom school, and 15 advantages of the individualized. And so he was just slightly leaning towards individualized, maybe. And he has experience in that, and he feels pretty positive about it. I said, yeah, but this thing, you know, working with the group and so on. By the way, he teaches Winter Bible School. And so I said, how'd you like to go to Winter Bible School and say you're teaching the Gospel of John? And so you hand the students a study guide and you say, all right, go to it. And you have a question, raise your hand. He said, yuck. And I said, well, what's the difference now? You say, you know, individualized is pretty good. He said, you know, you've got a widespread ability there in the elementary. He didn't put it in these words, but in other words, ages 8 to 11, you've got a lot more spread of ability than 18 to 21. So what he was saying was that he felt like he had a more homogeneous group in Bible school than what he had in his school, and that, you know, the one method worked better for the homogeneous group, and the other method worked better for the heterogeneous group. But so you see, you can't just say, oh, I'm definitely, this is always bad. Well, you can if you want to, but, you know, I think you have to see that each has their strengths and weaknesses. Let me read just a little bit here about Christopher Dock. Dock as a teacher was in marked contrast to most of the teachers of his time, as they have been described in the literature. For him, teaching was a life work instead of a sporadic occupation. He was well educated. He resided in the community where he taught, and he was greatly respected by his neighbors and friends. His motivation was strongly religious, and his educational activity was subordinated to moral and religious training. Doc's ideas about teaching were quite at variance with ideas then generally held by teachers and others of his day. He was ingenious in his methods of teaching. He employed various means to enlist the interest of the children and encourage their learning. He was systematic in conducting his school. In the discipline of children in school, he was far ahead of his time. He anticipated many ideas about education that are generally accepted today, and he did use some grouping. Here, then, was a devoted teacher who did a noble work in the obscurity of the Pennsylvania backcountry. Is that Guy's Mills? The frontier wasn't that far yet. Now, to a more serious note, though, for his labors, he hoped that as a reward, he might sometime, out of grace, receive a good testimonial and witness from the great shepherd of the sheep. And one more quote about Doc. Teaching for Doc was a divine and sacred trust. He believed that the extreme love which he felt toward the children had been given him by God to qualify him for his task of teaching. He considered that love as the single most important teaching qualification, divinely given to be divinely used. And Doc had an unshakable confidence in the power of that divine love to soften the hardest resistance to righteousness into a pliable will which could be molded by the help of God. Christopher Doc never betrayed his trust as a Christian schoolmaster. May God grant us many teachers who will follow him as he followed Christ.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.